Want to rise above what holds you back? These are the stories of those fighting that battle. It might also be the story of you. I'm Dan Waldschmidt, author of Edgy Conversations and strategist of billion-dollar companies all over the world. This is Mark Menard, author of The Story of You, the guy who knows a thing or two about never giving up. You're listening to Elevating Beyond. Let's get started.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Elevating Beyond with a two-word mission statement: change lives. Well, first of all, those of you watching on camera on the YouTube channel and all that good stuff, I got my first freaking haircut in like 3.5 months, or whenever all this insanity began, 3 months ago it's been, or something. This has been craziness, but we're all pushing through it. Imagine the timing for all this. That's why I always say God is orchestrating, because economically, a lot of people have been comparing this to things like the depression they were facing as small businesses, as large businesses, whatever size that you have. Imagine it's in the midst of the depression. And not only do you say like, okay, what am I going to do, just like now during COVID, to keep my business going? What if I took something to an entire new freaking level, like this guy did, who started something you may have heard of called Sheraton Hotels? He started it amidst the Great Depression and ended up having over 400 Sheraton hotels with over 20,000 employees. And I have a huge surprise for you today, because today's guest is Mitzi Perdue. That's right, that's his daughter. And she's going to share stories that people have never heard before of what her dad went through and how he overcame all this adversity amongst the crisis to start Sheraton Hotels, not to mention her own story. Mitzi is amazing. Her and her late husband then owned Perdue Farms, a multi-billion-dollar company with over 20,000 employees that they built up. We're talking massive experience. She has her book here, How to Be Up in Down Times. You can see it on screen. Boom, forward by my good man, Mark Victor Hansen, who was just on the show last week, author of Chicken Soup for the Soul, the one that got rejected 144 times, and then now has sold over 500 million copies to date, which is freaking wonderfully insane. And she co-authored the book with Preston Weeks, and she's going to talk all about how to be up and down times, and share the story behind the story, the unheard, untold stories of her dad founding Sheraton Hotels amidst the Great Depression. So stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen, as we get ready to join up here with Mitzi. Welcome to the show. As everyone knows, I just did the intro here of the wonderful Mitzi Perdue. Even in the intro, I couldn't even begin. We were talking pre-show, and Mitzi also was telling me about how she even was in radio broadcasting for 8 years. I could spend the next hour just going over all the things Mitzi has done, and the show would be over. How are you doing today, Mitzi, first of all?
Well, I'm as up as a person can be. I love visiting with you. I love visiting with your audience. So this is cool.
That's awesome. And Mitzi, it looks beautiful where the room you're in, the lighting, everything. Where are you located?
Salisbury, Maryland, which is where Perdue Farms headquarters is.
Nice. And I was saying this on the intro, if I said it correctly, in addition to your father who founded Sheraton during the Depression, we're going to talk about, then your family-owned business, Perdue Farms, is it still over 20,000 employees?
Yeah, and we're celebrating our 100th anniversary this year.
I have had so many different business owners on over the years of all levels, and I think you win the award. Woo-hoo. For the longest owner. You know, I remember celebrating the 10-year mark with my company, and I'm like, we hit the 10-year mark, because I read that the failure rate is so high, and I don't read all those statistics, because when we're doing our company, we're just in the trenches doing it. But the first year failure rate wasn't as high as it was between like year 5 and 10. At least that's what a recent article in Forbes had. So I'm like, yes, we passed the 10-year mark. We're at 13 years. Now, when you're hitting a century, that's a whole other level.
I'll give you a statistic on that. It comes from my hero friend, Dennis Jaffe, who spends full time studying what makes a family business last. And he says that the odds of a company lasting 100 years are 1 in 1,000. It's an achievement to get that far, and it doesn't happen by accident.
Yeah.
On the other hand, since my family of birth began 180 years ago, I'm associated with two families who cracked the code, who learned how to do it.
I'm so excited to hear about this. And also, I was sharing with everyone too, Mitzi's book, How to Be Up in Down Times, that the foreword was written by Mark Victor Hansen, who, as you all know, was just on the show, author of Chicken Soup for the Soul, that was rejected 144 times, sold over 500 million copies. That's beyond Stephen King's, I think, highest selling novel. I love it. And co-authored by Preston Weeks, which you just informed me too, is Mark Victor Hansen's stepson, which is very interesting to me. So there's so much wisdom that I can tell already. Thank you for sending this book in How to Be Up in Down Times. And speaking of down times, Mitzi, I believe it was your dad with your uncle, if it's correct, started Sheraton during the Great Depression, which a lot of people are, this whole thing with COVID, we don't know how long it's going to last, but it's a similar feeling where there's all this fear and anxiety. And some people are just like, I just want to be stagnant. And so then how does someone like your dad and being the daughter, what did you see to where did the idea come from of during like the worst economic downfall? Hey, let's start a hotel, not only a hotel, but then bring it to over 400 with over 20,000 employees. Do you remember?
Lots and lots and lots. Because when I was a little girl, it was just so clear to me that my dad was different from other dads. Part of the difference was our summer house had a ballroom that held 200 people. As a little girl growing up and looking at how my neighbors lived and how we lived, it was just really clear that father had accomplished something that made him totally different. So as a child, I was forever asking him how he did it. And one of the stories, and this is going to go right back to the Great Depression. In fact, imagine for a moment that we're back in 1933, and that was pretty much the worst of the Great Depression. At that point, it was really quite similar to right now, because back then there was 25% unemployment, and nobody wanted to have anything to do with real estate. And that meant that hotels were just going bankrupt right and left. And so what enabled my dear father and my uncle to recognize an opportunity when everybody was running away from it? And I would love to share the story of how my father was able to make a success of hotels when everybody else was going bankrupt. And so I invited you to come back to 1933, and it's one of his first hotels. But the story I'm about to tell you, he did it with every hotel that he ever got. And there, at the time of his death, he owned 400. Well, when he'd take over a hotel, typically it would be teetering on bankruptcy, the kind of thing where you could get property for almost 10 cents in the dollar. And the day that he'd take possession, he would invite everybody, and it could be 400 people, it could even be 800 if it was a large hotel. He'd invite all of the employees to come into the hotel ballroom, and he'd stand up on the stage in front of them. And here's something that he knew. I mean, it's kind of obvious to us, but nevertheless, he told me that he knew it, that everybody in that audience is demoralized. They're afraid that they're going to lose their job, because it's the most normal thing in the world for somebody takes over something that's failing to clean house, have new blood, maybe take care of your friends and relatives. Father knew that on their minds would be, if I get fired, it's the breadline for me. I won't be able to get another job. Doesn't that sound even a little like now? Well, anyway, to continue the story. So he stands up in front of his audience, and the first words out of his mouth are, "You keep your job. I want you to stay here." And then his next words were, "I want you to stay here because nobody knows this hotel better than you do. Nobody knows your job better than you do. And we're partners in this. My job is to give you the resources and the support to show the world just how good you are. And you're going to see in a matter of months, this hotel's going to turn around. We're going to be the best served, the most popular, the most successful hotel in the whole city. And we're going to be an example to the rest of the city that things can turn around." Well, those were his first words. The next day, the employees got to see that he really meant it, because they would witness, you know, troops, cavalcades of workers coming in who were like electricians, decorators, designers that come in to help refurbish the hotel to bring it back to its former splendor. But all those plumbers, decorators, whoever else, electricians, they didn't come to the areas that the public would see. No, they went to the areas that only the employees would see, like the employee dining rooms, kitchens, lockers, showers.
So he intentionally had them go to see, whoa, they're making the stuff they're prioritizing.
Exactly. Wow, okay. So I asked Father, why didn't you spend the money just right off on places where you'd help get your money back? And he said, because I wanted to signal to the workers how important they were. And then he told me a phrase that I'm just eager to share with our audience. And that is, people have a compulsion to live up to or down to your expectations. So spending his first money there was a way of communicating to them how important they were. Even that's not quite the end of the story, because I challenged him and I said, okay, I can see spending the first money on areas that only the employees would see, but why did you promise everybody that they could keep their job? And he said that persuasion comes in three flavors, and you can get people, he said, I could have stood up in front of 400 people and told them, shape up or you lose your job. That's intimidation. And he says, that's not a good way, because with intimidation, people will behave the way you want, but they're going to do it grudgingly. They're going to do the minimum that they can get by with. So the first flavor is intimidation. The next is bribery. So how does bribery work? He could have stood up there and said, I'm going to give you all a raise if you do a good job. There are bonuses if the hotel succeeds. And he said, the problem with bribery is it's too transactional. People work exactly for what they're going to get rewarded for, but they're not into something bigger. Mm. And you have to keep upping the ante. So what was the third? I could invite you to guess, but I'll spare you. I'll just tell you. He said the real way to get compliance, to get engagement, to get people to go the extra mile, to be committed, is to inspire, don't require. Cool?
I love it. I'm so fascinated by leadership and my own journey of doing it wrong, learning to do it. We never stop learning. But that first component there where he got up on the stage is, and during this time, especially in times of doubt and fear, you need to over-communicate versus under-communicate. Because I met with CEOs of very large corporations that said they haven't had any contact or communication with their employees, and some for 2 months. And I was like, oh my God. And they're like, well, we don't know what's going on. It's better to get up there and say, we're working our butt off through this. We're doing our best. I'm going to be honest, we don't know exactly what tomorrow looks like, but I can guarantee you, give them something. Because when people are left in the dark, our minds default to the worst case scenario.
Absolutely.
And so he knew that. And I love it too, because a lot of people, especially they think in the 1930s, people seem to think that, and maybe I don't know, but they seem to think the majority of business owners and stuff led based off of fear, which obviously your dad didn't.
Well, it's possible that the others did, because after all, he was doing something different and he made a success when others failed.
That's true. That's actually very true. And these are the ongoing similarities that I continue to see in companies that really build. You're the first one that I've seen that's been over a century or hit a century, which is amazing, but hit those decades and even start to have some generations. It's built off that leadership and starting like with the owner having that servant leadership mindset. I'm thinking back to Mitzi when he went to open his first hotel at that time before he started purchasing other ones. When he went to purchase other ones, it sounds like he kind of started to have a structure down, where he had his subcontracted teams come in and do the work, and maybe they had started branding it as Sheraton and having a certain look or splendor, like you said, that they bring to him. Did he share with you when they were like getting their first one and they were going into that unknown?
Yeah, my impression is that he never intended to be in the hotel business, and he didn't subcontract with others. Now, whenever he'd take over a hotel, he would keep the existing employees. The Sheraton hotels, at least during his lifetime, we did sell the company when he passed down in 1967. But during the period of his lifetime, no, we owned the hotels, and the people who worked there worked for him. And one of the things that I'm kind of proud of is that there was like a saying, if you started with my father, you stayed with him for life because you felt loyalty to him. I want to build on something you said a moment ago, which is that he wasn't like our image of the greedy capitalist in the 1930s, that he was into servant leadership. But he came about that from what I take take to be an encouraging story, but maybe almost a shocking one. When he was 26 years old, he was kind of completely at loose ends. He didn't know what he wanted to do. And at that point, and we're talking 1926, he had gotten engaged to my mother. And my mother came to Cambridge, Massachusetts to meet her future in-laws. And Grandmother Berta told Mother, "Don't marry Ernest. He can never stick to anything. You're going to end up poor." And she said, "I don't care. I love him." So they married. Well, it was true. At the beginning, he couldn't stick to anything. And so finally, he went to a career guidance counselor, picked somebody out of the Yellow Pages, and spent a whole day getting guidance on what his strengths and his weaknesses were and what he should probably do as a career. And the guidance counselor told him, "Mr. Henderson, you're clearly a very smart person, but you have absolutely no social skills or empathy or understanding of any sort, and you should never have any kind of job that involves interacting with the public. Maybe you could have a career as a scientist in a laboratory, not interacting with anybody." And I do believe it's true that he started out with zero. I mean, he had to be, I don't know, in today's terminology, it might have been Asperger's or who knows what, but he just didn't have people skills. But he took that as a challenge. He said, "I'm going to learn. I'm going to crack the code." And he began taking courses in psychology, reading books. I know, or he told me, that every 10 years he would read How to Win Friends and Influence People, trying to figure out in the deepest possible level what makes people tick, what motivates them. And so his biggest deficit became his greatest strength, because since he recognized, I really suck at this, he overcame it. And even growing up as a child, I know that he cultivated some of the world's most famous psychologists. This is somebody who's really famous, like in the 1950s, B.F. Skinner. B.F. Skinner would be a weekend guest at our house.
No way.
This
is mind-blowing to me. Go ahead.
And Eddie Bernays, who's known, I think, as the father of modern advertising, you know, he was a frequent house guest, as if he was studying for a doctoral dissertation, learning what motivates people. And look how far it took him, because since he didn't just take it for granted, since he studied it, that gave him the understanding to stand up in front of that crowd at the hotel that he had just taken over and understand that they're terrified, that they're not going to listen to a word he says when they're worried about, am I going on the bread line? No, until he takes away that pain point, they're not going to listen. And he understood that. But how many people back in the 1930s who had never studied psychology or recognized that they had a deficit, how many would have done it?
It's so funny, because that's like my story and a lot of our stories. I didn't do good in school because I was bored to death. They said I had A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all this stuff. I got in trouble in my teens. One art teacher told me kids like me should just drop out of high school. All this fun stuff. I remember thinking, I'm not like those smart kids. I used to falsely believe that, leaders are just born and blah, all this stuff. And as you clearly just said, and as I learned in my own journey, I'm sure you have to, is we're built. And you kept mentioning skill and that power of self-awareness and dropping your ego is such a key. Like your dad is, some people are so self-conscious that they don't want to admit, I don't have a deficit in that area. But those that can be like, man, actually, because me, I'll speak on stage and stuff. I'm more introverted, I guess, at times. I think it's because a lot of us entrepreneurs, we just observe and sort of see the world differently than a lot of other people. But when I'm up there and I'm passionate, people are like, you're not introverted. A lot of times, if I'm talking to the right person, like someone like you, Mitzi, like I can be going all day long because I'm so fascinated by it. But in a lot of everyday talk is kind of harder for me, and I can be more introverted in some of those type situations. And people don't understand that. Like exactly what your dad did. He started just absorbing himself into all that information. And if you can't get the famous, I studied Skinner in college.
Did you really? Oh my God. Hey, he was a real cool guy, and he was funny, and he was just easy to get along with. I loved him.
I remember learning about him in college. I had my BS in psychology. Yeah, that's what blows my mind, hearing someone that actually spent time. So I'm imagining it was like when I'm learning about other figures throughout history and stuff. And so your dad would study and get to a point where he would be able to have these people in his life, which is what I love about podcasts now, because I'm able to connect with amazing amazing people like you, Mitzi, and the technology, we're able to now bring people sitting here with us to 55 different countries, and they're able to hear these amazing stories and wisdom that they can apply to their own lives. And knowing that too, I think, is so helpful. I know the younger me would have loved hearing, like, wow, Mitzi's father, who's founded Sheraton Hotels, there was a point in time where he was introverted and didn't have good social skills and was told by a guidance counselor like me, like, you shouldn't be going after this type of dream and you can't be in this. And he was able to learn that and take that on, like you said, as a challenge, get focused into his leadership skills and build himself up. I don't even have words to describe to build something like the Sheraton. It just blows me away.
Well, as I told you, when I was a child, I was forever asking him how you do it. And he said that people skills were just the most important thing, and that Sheraton would never have been anything if it weren't for the people who worked with him. So I think I'm sort of developing this thought as we speak, but what if the most important skill there is people skills? And he seems to have recognized that, because if you want people to go the extra mile, to be committed, to use their creativity, to love their job, you got to have some people skills to understand what motivates them. Allow me to a quote that I memorized from my father. He said that a leader's job is to give people a better vision of themselves. Let me tell you how that plays out. I don't tell anybody anything, but let me share how that would play out. Because he would say, the hotels became a success because a woman, say, waiting table or making beds, or a guy, I don't know, carrying bags or something, or bartending, they're not just waiting table or bartending or whatever. No, they're part of a team building the most successful, inspirational hotel in the city. And if you have a better vision of yourself, if you're doing more than tending bar or whatever, you're excited to come to work, you're part of a team, you contribute more, there's just more energy. I love his vision that a leader's job is to give people a better vision of themselves.
You know, Mitzi, this is so spot on with everything that I apply in my life and what I learned from all the greats, like you, like your dad. It's so awesome to see the caring and the empathy and also understanding different personalities. I had my guest, Chris Hogan. I don't know if you're familiar with Dave Ramsey or not. Okay, cool. So I spent a lot of time with Dave Ramsey and his team. They took me to another level on my leadership. And that's what pushed me to open my podcast. That's a whole other story. But anyway, so Chris Hogan from Dave Ramsey, one of his head personalities from his team, had a quote that was just like your dad's. He said, leadership isn't about making better workers. It's about making better people. I was like, yes, because I know in our all team meetings, we share our wins and our losses. And like what your dad said, helping people make, what was it, better?
Having a better vision of themselves. And I'm trying to remember whether he said a higher vision of themselves or a better vision of themselves. But you get the point that they're not waiting table. They're part of a team building the best hotel.
That's right. And you explain the importance of it and the why and the mission, because the power of unity, you can get more done with less of the right people. When they come together and they really unify over this mission, you get this whole new level of momentum. And I'm sure that your dad did all the, I mean, these other things where you could have accountants and CPAs, and they would be like, that doesn't financially make sense that you're spending all this money on investing and making the locker room nicer for the employees and fixing their kitchen up when right now you're not having guests and bringing revenue. But your dad was able to see way, way beyond that and be like, no, you don't understand. You can't measure the ROI of that, because the unity that is going to build up and the momentum from that is going to be the foundation of what's going to take this whole place to another level.
And the ROI of treating employees well. I think I mentioned that he never expected to be in the hotel business, but there was one that was available and the price was right and he couldn't resist it. And so he and my uncle bought it. And he wasn't expecting to continue, but with his attitude of just treasuring and valuing and appreciating the work of the people who were there and making them all feel just really, 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 really important. The wonderful thing is that in a matter of months, it did become strikingly successful. People would want to go there. I've been told that you walk into any hotel, there's sort of a vibe. Well, during the Great Depression, the vibe was despair. But his hotels were kind of upbeat with people who were excited to be there and excited. And anyway, this initial hotel became enough of a success that, you know, the money started rolling in. And Father did not not live high in the hog. The Hendersons and the producer also, we value being frugal. So the money that he made, he plowed right back into buying another hotel. And the secret sauce worked. So we bought a third. And I wonder if our audience might enjoy knowing how the name Sheraton came about. Because it was with Third Hotel.
Yes.
Because you might wonder, why didn't he name it after himself? Why were they the Henderson Hotels? And it happened because in Springfield, Massachusetts, the third hotel he ever bought, there was this very nice hotel, but it had a great big neon sign that said Sheraton. Well, in the early 1930s, oh boy, that was just, to use a 1930s expression, that was the bee knees. I mean, if you had a neon sign, boy, you were it. But the former owner had spent $10,000 on this sign, and $10,000 in 1930s money, that's probably $500,000 in today's money.
Yeah.
Well, father is a good New England Yankee, couldn't bear to throw away a $10,000 sign, but you wanted to have the same name for advertising purposes. He even told me that he had several reasons. You know, first, you don't want to throw away a $10,000 sign. But second, he didn't feel the name Henderson was euphonious. It didn't have a nice ring to it. Mm. And he thought that Sheraton did. And third, he was a little concerned what would happen to the kids if our name was on the hotels.
Oh.
But I loved it that he was self-deprecating enough to realize that Henderson is not euphonious the way Sheraton is. I mean, to me, that just showed a kind of not being ego-driven that I admire no end.
Everything about that story behind the story that I've never heard. It's just so cool to hear those things because people sometimes get too obsessed in having a perfect business plan and they never start because they think that everyone that did it had it. And it's kind of like, how did you come up with the name Sheraton? Well, the sign was really expensive that was already up. And I thought about it, and hey, that name fit really well, actually. And it had a, what was the word you used? It wasn't splendor. It was
euphonious, which means it sounds good to the ear. It's got a nice ring to it.
I love that word, euphonious. That's a new one I'm going to have to add to my vocabulary. Okay,
I never would have known the word except I heard him use it. So, of course, Daddy, what does euphonious mean?
It perfectly describes it. That's such a great story. And so then that's how the name came about. And at what point in time, so then you mentioned being frugal and pouring back into the business, which I think is a good thing for people to learn through these times and stuff now too. So did he build up and did you also for your company, from what I read from Purdue Farms, if this is correct, it's a something like $6 billion a year company. Is that correct?
That's correct.
To take financial advice from you running and owning that company, do you guys have a certain amount? I know when I work with Dave Ramsey and stuff, the first goal was to get 6 months in savings of, first of all, to meet of all payroll and savings. Then the next goal they had was to get like 6 months in savings, actually of all gross expenses to be able to really weather these storms. I'm just curious as to if you guys had anything like that. I'm sure it's at a whole other level when you're getting into the billions versus the multi-millions.
Well, the family ethic from forever has been to be frugal. Even Frank Perdue, he was in the Fortune 400, I guess it's the Forbes 400 for being wealthy. This was a man who had plenty, but up until in his 80s, when it was medically necessary, we went economy class. In all the cities, we traveled a huge amount because in a good year, we could sell in up to 100 different countries. This is not a good year, but at its height, we would be traveling to meet the different buyers. And that means we'd travel in the major capitals of the world. But somebody as successful as Frank Perdue could easily have driven around in a chauffeur-driven limousine. Nope, we went by subway. I know subways in, let's see, that's a wrong word. It's not that I know them, but at least I have used comfortably and enjoyably the subways in Moscow, Tokyo, Beijing, just all over the world. We went by subway. And I admired Frank endlessly for that. In fact, I would like to make a bet that there are few people who aren't New Yorkers who know this New York subway system as well as Frank did. He didn't slather money on things that didn't matter.
I'm always about, there's something that you're in love with and you really enjoy it. That's great to enjoy some of the fruits of your hard work and of your labor. But when people are just trying to get with social media and stuff, I don't know if you have seen it as much, but on things such as Instagram, it'll make me laugh. Well, people, they'll have stacks of cash sitting on their bed or something with gold, diamond net, and take pictures of it and put like hashtag entrepreneur, buy my course to make in 30 days to be a blah. And I'm just thinking, no one that has money does that, would do that.
Never. But each family's got its own culture, and ours is that we value being frugal. I mean, like right now, I could certainly afford to fly first class wherever I go. I have visited China for like 12 times. I always go economy. Well, partly because, all right, two professions. It seems to me that it would be so easy for me, Mitzi Purdue, to live in a total bubble because I'm a Sherritt Naris and I'm Frank Purdue's widow. It seems to me that one of the ways of trying to escape living in a bubble and getting to meet people that I wouldn't come across in a bubble, that's going to happen in subways, it's going to happen on buses, it's going to happen on economy class flights. I love it and treasure it, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
The only reason when I travel, if I'm doing a lot of events, I'll do first class is because my legs are so long. It's needing the leg space for me half the time, and I'm able to sometimes rest and get more done and be prepped for where I am.
So there's a reason in your case. In my case, I'm 5'6". It makes absolutely no difference other than there's a whole lot more calories in first class, which I don't really want. But I'm not trying to impose my view on other people. I'm sharing with you what works for me. I think a frugal approach to life, it works wonderfully. In both the Hendersons and the Purdues, the parents put huge effort in having kids not grow up spoiled. And that meant having very much smaller allowances than anybody else did. And I remember as a child when I wanted something and I'd ask my father, the automatic response would be, earn it.
I love it. That's what I had a great person like your dad teach me is instead of saying, Dad, will you get me this, saying, what can I do to earn this?
Perfect. Because a spoiled child is going to be unhappy and he or she's going to make the parents miserable. I think it's a really good investment to take advantage of. Somebody once told me that the most powerful word in the English language, as far as a parent is the word no. With my own kids, I had no problem saying no. And my parents sure had no problem saying no. And if my kids would ask, but the neighbors are doing so and so, and I'd say, we're not the neighbors. We love you enough to say no.
That's right. Mitzi, it's amazing to me because I've seen on both ends, I'm sure you have too, on both ends of it too, where some people have been so successful and they came from nothing. Even with good intentions, they wanted to just give their kids a life they never have. So they overspoiled them. But then they realize, oh gosh, I gave my kids everything except what it took to make me successful, which is the grit and the determination and the character and the work ethic. I didn't teach them those real values. Then when they're gone, and a lot of cases, like here in Ohio, there's that $1 billion company that made the baskets. I don't know if you remember, Long and Meyer?
Yeah. What happened to them?
It went bankrupt.
No. Now. Oh, dear.
Yeah. I don't know how many generations down it was. And I don't personally know the sons that ended up running it. I can only say from what I heard from someone I know who did some consulting and some things like the news. But from what I read, they kind of took it over and it was just sort of handed to them too easily. And they had everything given to them a lot of their lives, except they weren't taught like what you were taught to really have that vision and that passion. They ended up this company, and it had been around for, I think it was close to 100 years also. Even the building itself was a $1 billion building. Oh. It was a giant basket. And they bankrupted it because it was like the parents gave them everything except what it takes to be successful and those leadership skills and everything that you learned when you were mad, like, well, my neighbors had it. And I'm sure there's times all of us parents give in at times, but overall, your dad taught you those skills and those principles and those values, which you then passed on to your kids. And would you say that has been a huge key in the shared values that you had with your husband with Purdue Farms? Did his parents raise him that same way?
One of the things that just most amazed me when I married Frank Purdue, that there was no adjustment period because the values were so similar. In both cases, huge emphasis on family, on giving back, on integrity. Frank did something that I just treasure. He created something called an ethical will. I mentioned that, by the way, in the book that I hope we discuss at some point, How to Be Up and Down Times. Here's a couple of pages from it. When Frank was in his 80s, he knew that those who came after him, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, they were going to inherit a lot of material wealth, but he wanted to make sure that they were happy as well as well off. And his view was happiness comes from following your highest values. If you're honest, people people will respect you. If you have integrity, you're probably going to get the good jobs. You'll have good friends that last a lifetime. He created an ethical will. In Frank's case, it was 10 values that he wanted those who came after him to embrace. We spent 3 or 4 days figuring this out. And Frank, he was in his 80s and his vision wasn't perfect, so he wasn't going to type. We'd discuss it and I'd take notes, type it up. And we went over every word of this ethical will probably 5 times. It was what he left his children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and so on, of what he felt it took to make a happy life. I'll share one of them, which I just think is just the essence of all wisdom. I'm being hyperbole, but I do take what I'm about to say as being just incredibly insightful and wise. If you want to be happy, think what you can do for somebody else. If you want to be miserable, think what's owed to you. Over and over again in my own life, if I'm miserable, I'm thinking, somebody owes me something.
Yeah.
If I'm happy, I'm probably, this is me at my best. If I'm ever at my best, I'm thinking what I can do for somebody else.
That's so true. It's so true. It puts you into that grateful mindset. And me too, when I get into that whole pity party, it's usually the woes me or what am I upset about or what don't I have or why don't I have this and why do they? But when you're doing something, that's, I really think, is the core of leadership too. And as you said in your book, How to Be Up and Down Times, you mentioned you have areas. Is that an area that you said that you talk about in there?
That happens to be on happiness.
Okay.
And I have another story on happiness since we're on happiness, and it comes from Mother Teresa and Napoleon Bonaparte. Again, this is a chapter in this book, but by coincidence, there was a week when I happened to read both a biography of Napoleon Bonaparte, the Emperor of France, a few hundred years ago, and Mother Teresa, who died somewhat recently. Well, Napoleon, by the standards of the world, there have been few more successful people as far as money, fame, power, influence, sex, whatever the world could offer. This man had it in greater concentration than had ever happened before and probably not many times since. So was he happy? Oh, we don't have to guess, because writing in exile in St. Helena at the end of his career as Emperor of France, he wrote that he couldn't name 5 happy days in his whole life.
Wow.
The wealth, the power, the fame, it didn't make him happy. All right, Mother Teresa, the contrast. She had a vow of poverty and humility. That meant that the possessions that she owned were 3 cotton saris and the sandals on her feet. That was the extent of her possessions. And she writes at the end of her life, "My life has been a feast of unending joy." Which is going to make you happy, being a giving person or a taking person?
And with that too, Mitzi, I'm sure you talk about it too, but I think so much that is tied to the giving into what becomes your purpose. Because I think people confuse passion a lot of times with thinking, I'm just going to feel passionate and excited about this every day. I'm going to have the money and the wealth. But that's not what passion is. It's really when you're going through hell that you have a purpose that pushes you through it. Someone who I love that I study a lot is Winston Churchill. And when you said subway, it made me think of him.
Subway scene.
I love during the war, he was trying to figure out what to do. As Nazi Germany, they were about to form an alliance. And the king, or was it the king, I believe? Oh, there's a great movie I watched on it. But
we watched the same one, and I'm pretty sure it was the king.
Yeah. A lot of people were making decisions based on fear. And he was, like a lot of us, people would say an outcast. But he was able to make this really heavy decision, and somewhere deep down was like, no, a lot of people are going to die if we go to war. But he rode the subway and people would be like, is that Winston Churchill? It shows him asking and really valuing the opinion of the people, saying, how do you feel about us being an alliance? We wouldn't have to go to war. I love that one lady. She's like, no way, over my dead. She's like, they can come into my house. I'll fight them with broomsticks. I'll fight them with pans. It almost makes me tear up.
Actually, I am tearing up. I mean, because courage is so inspirational.
Yes. And you see him standing there and it changed the course of history. And he said, you know, we would be standing here today and there'd be Nazi flags and we wouldn't have our freedom. I feel like this whole COVID thing, Mitzi, has made me appreciate the freedom that so many people have died for us to have in America too. I know I have easily taken for granted a lot of the times. I just love how you study the greats like Mother Teresa, Winston Churchill, and they had this purpose that was, I don't know how to describe it, but the common things like you of getting on the subway and dropping the ego and being humble enough to value people's opinions enough to say, I don't know exactly exactly what to do. And I want to get advice from everyone to be able to make the best possible decision. They changed the course of history. I know I'm going all over, but I had a quick question with you. When you're on Flying Economy and you're just talking to people, has the discussion ever come up when they're like, well, what do you do? And, well, I'm the wife of Frank Perdue. And have you heard of Perdue Farms? Has anyone ever been like, what, you own that? And then they see you sitting in economy with them. Has anything like that ever come up?
How about all the time? I don't tell them, but sometimes, what do you do? And maybe I've got a book that I've written or something, and it will say that I'm Mrs. Frank Perdue. I don't keep it a secret because I kind of enjoy being, I mean, I want them to be real. I'll do my best to be real. Yeah, it's kind of fun because, I don't know, I'm a big believer that you shouldn't be too full of ego, but guess what? I'm guilty and do as I say, not as I do, because I really enjoy interacting with somebody who wants to know about my life. And if I pretended to be just somebody else, I wouldn't get that little spark of joy of the real me connecting with the real you.
I wouldn't say that's ego. You were saying before, I would say that's more being authentic. I love people that are curious. I know if I was with you on an airplane flight, I would be so upset if I found out the flight ended and I didn't know who you were, because I wouldn't look at it as, oh, she's trying to expect. I would be so excited because I'm like, okay, if Mitzi's willing to stay awake, going to ask her so many questions because I'm so fascinated by her, the life she's lived and what she's accomplished and the wisdom that someone like you would have. I wouldn't look at it at all as an ego type thing. I think of it, it's more of you get excited and you're passionate about what you've done and what you do, and you're happy to talk about it, be authentic and share it with people.
Well, first of all, absolutely every word you say I agree with, but I want to add another sentence to it, which is, if I'm in an airplane and I'm talking with somebody, let's assume they have figured out I'm Frank Perdue's widow and they're surprised that I'm Flying Economy. The sentence that I would add to it is, I have an aspiration, which is to copy something that I witnessed Frank Perdue do his whole life, which is in a conversation, he would talk 10% and ask questions and listen 90%. Mm. So, you know, what I aspire to and probably fail at right and left is I would like to listen more than I talk.
It's funny you say that. Some shows I do with guests, sometimes it's just me rambling on. I interrupt all the time and I'm not trying to be rude. It's really genuinely I get excited and I'm like, oh, I got to jump in. I'll listen to them back on them. Sometimes I am like, oh my gosh, I cut that person off 50 times. People that listen and know me know that's just Mark and he's excited. Even when you're talking, believe it or not, I'm definitely not at the 10%, 90%. I'll try to be like, okay, don't let it finish. Because something like boils up and I'm excited and I want to ask and talk.
Well, I will tell you very frankly, the other side of that, I'm thinking as I'm talking, oh no, I'm monologuing. Shut up, Mitzi, cut this off.
I love it. I think that's a great thing for people to know too, that voice in our head that we have to try to, that I battle with to ignore it half the time when it's just telling you, you're doing this, and it's just like, shut up. And when you just get in the moment and be really you, because I always share that with people too, it never completely goes away. It's not like you just get to a point where you're just fearless and it'll tell me, Mark, you're not good enough to speak. You push through it and you do it anyway. Go into your book, How to Be Up and Down Times, and there couldn't be a better time for this. Can you share maybe one of the times that you were the most down, whether it was personally or in business, like a big part of adversity that you went through, and one of the keys of how you battled through that, whether it was internal fear or external circumstances, whatever it may be?
There was a time, I'm a Harvard graduate, and you know, I came from a successful family. So in theory, I should have been doing great things, but up to age, I guess, 35, I never really done much. I had invested in agricultural land in California, and that was going well, but you could be a rice farmer and not interact with a whole lot of people. So somewhere around age maybe 35, I started thinking, I would love a career in television. I would like a career as a writer, but I've never even tried. And I started thinking, and this was a pretty depressing thought, and I started thinking, why have I not used the skills, the education, the background that I have? And I realized I was afraid of failure. And so I decided that I would redefine failure. Failure was wasn't that you don't achieve your immediate goal. It was that you didn't try with all your heart and soul. And if you got turned down, if you failed the audition, if you got the rejection slip, that's paying your dues. That isn't real failure. And that in the course of trying, you've probably taken courses, in my case, public speaking courses right and left, and writing courses. In the process of trying, even if you get that failed audition or the rejection letter, you're farther along the road to success because you've met people, you've taken courses, you've developed skills.
You push through it and you do it anyway. Go into your book, How to Be Up and Down Times, and there couldn't be a better time for this. Can you share maybe one of the times that you were the most down, whether it was personally or in business? Like a big part of adversity that you went through and one of the keys of how you battled through that, whether it was internal fear or external circumstances, whatever it may be?
There was a time, I'm a Harvard graduate and you know I came from a successful family. So in theory, I should have been doing great things, but up to age, I guess, 35, I never really done much. I had invested in agricultural land in California, and that was going well, but you could be a rice farmer and not interact with a whole lot of people. So somewhere around age maybe 35, I started thinking, I would love a career in television. I would like a career as a writer, but I've never even tried. And I started thinking, and this was a pretty depressing thought, and I started thinking, why have I not used the skills, the education, the background that I have? And I realized I was afraid of failure. And so I decided that I would redefine failure. Failure wasn't that you don't achieve your immediate goal. It was that you didn't try with all your heart and soul. And if you got turned down, if you failed the audition, if you got the rejection slip, that's paying your dues. That isn't real failure. And that in the course of trying, you've probably taken courses, in my case, public speaking courses right and left, and writing courses. In the process of trying, even if you get that failed audition or the rejection letter, you're farther along the road to success because you've met people, you've taken courses, you've developed skills, and you're more likely, each failure is a step on the ladder towards success. And that helped me no end. And when the year that I came to that conclusion that I would redefine failure, began sending out things that I had written, rejection slips, sure. But eventually, there was kind of a breakthrough. I wrote an article for an in-flight magazine, and it became really popular. It was reproduced in like 200 newspapers.
That's awesome. Wow.
After all these rejection slips, oh my gosh, here it comes big. And that led to being syndicated. And so for a good bit of my life, I was the most widely syndicated environmental writer in the country, 420 newspapers. But if I hadn't gotten over the fear of rejection slips, this wouldn't have happened. And the same thing with television. My show was syndicated to 76 stations out of the CBS affiliate in Sacramento. To get that job, I took the Dale Carnegie salesmanship course, the Dale Carnegie management course, the Dale Carnegie public speaking course. You know, I did so much to get sort of farther along the competencies and the talent stack that it would take to get there. And it happened. But it didn't drop in my lap and I had to overcome fear of failure. Oh, and there was one other thing. I also had a terrible lisp. And a lisp, by the way, isn't just, it's not just something you hear, but when it's bad enough, you see it. Your tongue is in the wrong place. And that meant no possibility of, or at least a really diminished possibility of a TV career. So I went to a speech therapist. And at this point, I think I'm 37, maybe 36. And I say, can you help cure my lisp? And she said, nope, at your age, with the tools we have available at this time, and I think we're talking like maybe 1974, don't hold me to the dates because I'm not sure. She said, we can't do it. So I went to another speech therapist and she said, nope, can't be done. I went to a third. And the third one said, nope, can't be done, but I'd be happy to take your money. So for 9 months, I would commute. It was a 2-hour round trip from in Sacramento. And at the end of 9 months, I could finally hear the difference between a good S and a bad one. And by 12 months, I was over and that opened the doors to a TV career. But again, my television career did not drop in my lap. I fought for it.
Yeah, I love people hearing. I've yet to have really anyone on this show and through my life that I met, whether they're Fortune 500 business owners or whether they're NFL players, that had it just in their lap. It was like what you're saying too, like the NFL player was like, I would be, yeah, I was talented and have skill, but I also would stay when weightlifting was done. And I put in an extra 8 hours every day when the team was done at Ohio State. I had other players on the show that were like, yeah, that's why he went to the NFL. We did what coach said. He studied beyond what the coach said, put in thousands of extra hours. And then he mentioned like what you said too, he still would have that fear of failure and everything else. And he had to keep to sort of flip. I love how you said it. You flipped it instead of thinking it's a pass fail. It's more of like, no, it's paying your dues or what I call like your battle scars. Cause bios don't show battle scars a lot of the time. And where people put a period at the end of failure. No, it's more of like a dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
And it's like training and it's building your muscle. And so I could keep you on for so many more hours, Mitzi, but
I'm loving this. I really love this.
I'm trying to respect your time. Before you had the failure, like what flipped your mind? Was it just really to start being driven? Was it almost the fear of not going after your dreams became bigger than your fear of going after them and failing? Is that kind of like what gave you that tipping point to be like, I'm going to start doing it even if I get these rejection slips? Like when you attempted.
Well, there was an actual moment. I mean, like a second in time when I flipped from one to the other, from not doing anything, not going out in limb, not risking failure. And it came about in the following way. I was a rice farmer in Northern California, and I had a tenant. He was a tenant farmer who had, this is a statistical rarity, but he had an IQ of over 200. Yeah, over 200. And Psychology Today wrote a story about the 40 people that the Sanford-Binet IQ tests were calibrated on. And they found 40 people with IQs of over 200.
Wow.
And then the article in Psychology Today told what happened to most of them. Most of them ended up suicides or in car accidents that shouldn't have happened, or alcoholics, or, you know, in one way or another, they had, I think this is brutal, but almost failed lives.
Yes.
And in fact, how about that's accurate? Not almost. But there was one exception, this guy who was a rice farmer in Northern California who had a normal life. Well, that guy was my tenant. And I knew him very, very well, because if you spend hours walking through the fields, you know, looking at the rice and figuring out markets or whatever else, when you spend enough time with a person and you're talking the whole time, you can have a pretty good idea of what's making them tick. And what made, I'm going to use a fake name because I want to be respectful of the guy's memory. I mean, he's long gone, but anyway, we will call him Peter Smith. Peter, I learned that he had a purpose in life. He knew that he had been given this great, great gift of just more intelligence than is fathomable to normal people.
Yeah.
He wanted to, in thankfulness for this God-given gift, he wanted to write a great book, and he had the title for it, Life, an Owner's Manual. And it would be all the wisdom of the ages, everything that he could put together to help guide people to have the best life that they could, so people could be all they could be. Now, when he conceived this idea, he was like 20, but you know, I'm too wet behind the ears, can't do it now. And he felt the same way at 30, 40, 50, 60. And at 68, he's my tenant working on my farm, a tenant farmer with this IQ. And at age 68, he was diagnosed with terminal heart disease. They didn't think they could keep him alive for 4 months. Months to go have quadruple bypass surgery. Well, the story takes a twist now, because there's something called the Pritikin Clinic, which has a fabulous record of, you know, diet, exercise, meditation, whatever else. He went there for a month, and my gosh, his health was restored. You know, he could walk 10 miles. He lost 15 pounds. He lived another 30 years.
Wow. And
so I'm a big fan of the Pritikin Clinic. I don't know if it's still around, but Peter Smith had his life completely, you know, a U-turn courtesy of this Pritikin Clinic. And so when he told me that, you know, he had his energy back and his ambition back, and I told him, Peter, this is the most wonderful news I've ever heard. Write your book.
Yes.
And he said, yes, I just have to do a little bit more research and I'll be ready. And that told me, I knew him well enough to know why he wasn't going to plunge in and do it right now. He wasn't going to do it right now because I knew him well enough, so take my word for this. He was afraid that he'd write this book and it wouldn't be as good as he hoped for. And I thought, he's done the one thing guaranteed to produce failure, and that's not to try. And from this moment on, I don't care about the rejection slips. I don't care if I fall on my face when I try something. I don't care, because any one of these setbacks is a badge of honor.
When we were live here in the studio, talking a lot on what you were, famous comedian Damon Williams on, and he was saying how people told him, you know, you want to be a comedian? You're not even funny. But it was funny because in the middle of it, my wife was out of town and I was doing a show with them, and it was on a Saturday. I don't normally do shows on Saturdays, and she was trying to call me about something that was going on, and I wasn't supposed to be in a show. And I was like, I'm so sorry to interrupt. This is so unprofessional, but if I don't pick this up, my wife's going to be really pissed off at me. I answered it like live on the air, and I'm talking to my wife, and I ended up just leaving it in there. And it's funny because you can hear him talking, and he's still talking to the camera, like as I'm on the phone, kind of in the corner. And he's like, yeah, every married man knows that if he didn't pick that phone up, there'd be hell to pay. He's like, yeah. He's here alone at the house. His wife's gone. He's not supposed to be doing a show today. It was so funny. It was like he took it on and almost made a little comedy bit out of it. And I'm like, I'm leaving that in there. So,
but don't you think people like you for being real rather than being perfect?
Yes, absolutely, Mitzi. And it helps me to hear all my guests and stuff. And that's what inspires everyone. That's, you know, it goes back to that really profound story that you just shared with us, that true story of, and I say this a lot, sometimes you can be too smart for your own good. And it's like one of the key components I teach my team members and stuff. I've had people apply that had more degrees than a thermometer, a quadruple MBA, and they're showing me all these charts. And I'm like, I love it. That's great. Are you willing to learn how we do it our way? Because I built this from the ground up, and I love you to death. I know you can teach me a lot, but no one knows it more than me, how we started it and how our coach. So you have to be willing to learn, although you bring all these great things to the table. And they couldn't see past, oh no, like how you could know more than me. I have all these charts and so what's amazing is the person that's in that position now, my highest up leader, doesn't have, and I went to college, I'm not against that. She only had her high school diploma, but she came on and started working direct care with our individuals, was the hardest worker, was so willing to grow. I took her under my wing, developed her over the years. Now she is the head admin. I actually am grooming her for the possibilities as CEO in the future. It because she has had this hungerness and this willingness to grow and has been challenged in every area and is doing better than that person that had 15 MBAs and all that stuff, because that willingness to, sometimes when you're too smart, like it, maybe it's an ego or maybe it's really, they're so used to like having it all and getting straight A's that they're over preparing in their head that if I have a book out, it has to be perfect. But as you and I know, when the first copy of my last book went out, even after all the edits and stuff, there's still type people with some, hey, on, it's like 1 out of every 1,000 people that's like, hey, on page 15, there's a typo. Most other people don't notice. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I fixed it twice and the publisher keeps charging all this money. I'm least, screw it. Like on page 14, I don't care. It's a bad look. It says bestseller.
Yes. Okay. I have a motto that guides my life, which is done is better than perfect.
Yes. That's so true. If you wait, I believe in God, and I don't preach down people's throats, but I'm just, even so many principles in there. It says if you wait for perfect conditions, you'll never get anything accomplished. And sometimes, Mitzi, I'm on the other side where I'll do it way too quick. I'll be like, let's do this, let's, you know, chase the shiny object. And then I'll have, and that's the greatness of a team, is you can have some of those people that are like, wait, Mark, if you're building a bridge, let's make sure that you actually are using the right pieces. So with someone driving over it, the car, it's not going to collapse. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot to look into what, I don't build bridges, I'm using that as an analogy, but you know what I mean? So we help balance each other out by having an amazing team and stuff around us. But Mitzi, I literally could, I could take your whole day up. You're such a fascinating...
Oh, thank you so much.
Yes, this has been an honor, and we have been booked up for guests. We're blessed to have so many amazing people out there writing us each week to be on the show. It was after interviewing Mark and his lovely wife, Crystal, and he's in the middle of the show, like, we're just talking like we were now, and all of a sudden he's like, and it was funny, he just went off, he's like, Mitzi, and I'm like, what? What are we talking? He's like, she would... And I left it in the episode and everything. He's like, I'm just thinking from talking to you and stuff, Mark, I'm going to get you in touch with her. She would love, be so great for your show. I could see you guys having a great conversation. And because of the authenticity, like you said, that Mark and his wife Crystal had, because gosh, we had a great conversation. And they were so open about their, we talked about the whole COVID thing and it wasn't just all scripted. I mean, we talked about everything. And through that interview and the trust that was built from that, immediately when he recommended you, I was like, without a doubt, I will make a spot for Mitzi. I know Jessica wrote you, my awesome assistant. Thank you, Jessica. You're amazing.
Thank you, Jessica. By the way, she's wonderful to deal with.
Oh, thank you. She's going to love hearing that. I appreciate that. And she mentioned you had a couple of weeks up. Let's get her in. Mark said wonderful things. And then I was reading your backstory and you have over-delivered. I mean, this has just been, I'm serious, Mitzi. Like, people like you are, it fuels me up. It inspires me just to see how much more I can grow and push myself and just the common struggles that we all go through and are able to break past these barriers. And what you're still accomplishing, your newest book, Mitzi Again, How to Be Up in Down Times, the foreword by Mark Victor Hansen, written by Mitzi Perdue, co-authored by Preston Weeks. So where were the best place for all of our listeners to go? We'll have a link in the show notes and all that. Is there
Amazon.
A website or
Amazon?
It's the easiest way to do it. Go to Amazon and just type in How to Be Up in Down Times and it will pop up. I love the cover too, how you have the little, hold it up here again for the on-camera show, describe it for
That's
the
courtesy
audio.
Of, courtesy of this wonderful online company, 99 Designs.
I've used them too. That's great. I love how they did the little smiley face.
Yeah.
That's great, Mitzi. That's another thing too. You use 99 Designs. They helped design it. You didn't have to get some type of book cover designer that would say, I'll charge you $30,000 to make a book cover or something that's ridiculous. People will do that sometimes. Through 99 Designs, I've even had my recent book that's on pre-order, and this isn't about me. I'm not even going to mention the name of it. It's about you.
I'd mention it so that I can order it.
Oh, geez. It's 16 Reasons Why Your Business Sucks.
Frank Perdue used to say, tell me what's wrong, not what's right, because I can do something about what's wrong. I love your approach.
Oh, it's 16 Reasons Why Your Business Sucks. And then the subtitle is How to Be Freaking Awesome at Every Level of Your Business, Leadership, Profits, and Build Your Own Dream Team. It's been 3 years in the making, and it's 13 years of, and I feel foolish acting like 13 years is a lot of experience of building a business when I'm talking to someone who's has one that's a century plus.
It's family-owned business. I don't run it. I'm part of the family.
Well, absolutely. But you've been very, very involved throughout your time in life and components of running it. And it's being around so many other great people like you and other leaders that I've intertwined what I've learned and what I've applied and what I share throughout the book, too, of areas where in each area I talk about, hey, I sucked at this, and here's how I learned to be. It's able to be like, you freaking suck at dealing with conflict. Every chapter starts with you suck at something. And yeah, there's a whole other side story there. 3 years, and I had one publisher go bankrupt in the middle. So many times I wanted to give up on it, and that just makes for a better story behind the story. And then it's now up for pre-order during COVID. I figured out how to self-publish it and all that and got it up there. It's pre-order, but we'll have the physical copies. But geez, I'm the worst host as I'm doing like a plug for my book.
Oh, no, but I asked you.
To the show.
Remember, I asked you. I said, when is it going to come out and what's its name? So you were being responsive. That you're a good host.
I appreciate it. And Mitzi, when it does too, I'll personally send you a signed copy.
I'd love that.
That would be great. And so everyone go to Amazon, check out Mitzi's book, How to Be Up in Down Times. And Mitzi, is there a website or anything else or just best?
I have my own website. If people would like to contact me, I promise to answer anybody who writes to me. It's a pretty simple one. It's my name, MitziPerdue.com.
That's the way to do it. Mitzi, M-I-T P-E-R-D-U-E, Purdue, P-E-R-D-U-E.com. How to be up and down times. Mitzi, it's been an honor. I normally do a couple takeaways at the end of each show, but that would be a whole other hour because Mitzi went over so many between her and her amazing late husband, Frank, and her family and her father. There's so much to take away. I think at the core of it, I just kept seeing the true leadership and success is much more about your purpose. And it's really about serving others and not just selfishly serving yourself. And really another gigantic takeaway was what Mitzi said, sharing that story of the wonderful man with an IQ of 200 that just you can have everything and you're waiting for these perfect conditions. And the biggest failure is to not go after what's really your dream and your purpose and to truly go after it. Like you said, Mitzi, to fail is paying your dues. I love that. The game doesn't end there. It's part of paying your dues to really get to that next level. So thank you so much, Mitzi. It's been an honor. And everyone listening, you're going to push through this. Get Mitzi's book and never settle. Never give up. Keep elevating beyond.